We will do the economic week in a distinctly non-economic news environment, because that is our job. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today. This one is the 20th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There has been the story this week, the hour-to-hour happenings of which have been covered basically everywhere else. But the economy waits for no one, not this week, not ever. So to it we shall get. Catherine Rampell writes for The Washington Post. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, we will start, for lack of a better place, with the Federal Reserve. The minutes of their last meeting, the July meeting, came out this week. Much consternation amid the chattering class about increased discussion of the taper, the Fed slowing its bond buying program. With the look ahead that the Fed, there's a big Fed meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, now virtual, by the way. Next week, Jay Powell is going to give a speech. What are you looking for and why does it matter?
Well, I think the fact that even the famed Jackson Hole meetings have gone virtual, probably not a great sign for how the Fed feels about the risk of the Delta variant right now for all kinds of economic activity, including conference meetings. But in any event, I think everybody's going to be looking for any clue as to taper talk, because the prospect of any form of stimulus being reduced as Delta-related infections are rising and supply chain issues continue could potentially spook markets, but you had the minutes come out recently suggesting a little bit of hawkishness from members of the Fed. So people are going to be looking for that. I think also any commentary whatsoever about the inflation outlook, you know, the Fed has characterized pricing pressures as being transitory, to use the term of art. That transition has been lasting a little bit longer than anybody forecast before, or most people forecast before. So how does Powell characterize pricing pressures going forward?
Hey, so Lynette, has the Fed waited too long to start pulling the support? I mean, the economy, you know, yes, Delta, but the economy's been strong now for a while. And there is some critique of the Fed that says, listen, man, why are you still, you know, pumping things up?
Well, we haven't reached our mandate of full employment. Mm-hmm. You know, we still 6 million, 7 million jobs mm-hmm. in the hole from where we started. And there are, you know, again, there's this giant worry about the Delta variant. One thing that I'm eager to hear from the Fed is whether or not they're concerned about what's going on in China right now. The Chinese government is, you know, taking massive industries, talking about people. It looks like China is closing its economy in a way we haven't seen in multiple decades. Yeah. And I wonder what that means for global growth. And I don't know if they're going to talk about that at Jackson Hole, but I want to know.
Well, if Lynette wants to know. But look, do you really expect Jay Powell, Lynette, to take that on in addition to, oh, by the way, the Delta variant and what's going on in this economy?
Who has a choice? You know, we have to worry about what the world is doing to make our own plans. We know that because Europe is, you know, not recovering from the pandemic as quickly as we are. We have to worry about what the world is doing.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And yes, agreed. Catherine, I am obliged here to point out that a lot of the support the economy's been getting on the fiscal side, that is to say from Congress in the form of relief and unemployment benefits and all of those things, those go away in something like, what is it now, 2.5-ish weeks. Does that concern you?
It's been hard to know whether, for example, the supplemental unemployment benefits have been helping or hurting job growth. To date, last year, it looked like it was having no effect, you know, but we were in a different situation then. This was earlier in the pandemic. Now there's this heated debate about whether these benefits are holding people back from returning to the workforce, from accepting jobs, or they're keeping people afloat because they can't go back to work, either because there aren't jobs in their field or they don't have childcare or what have you. So the numbers that we've seen so far kind of don't really shed any light one way or the other about whether, like, the states that have already withdrawn their supplemental UI unemployment insurance benefits, whether they've had faster job growth or not. It's like very hard to disentangle all these different things. So it's hard to say. I think that the argument has been that too much of the fiscal stimulus in general was front-loaded, and it would have been helpful to spread out some of that, whatever it was, $1.9 trillion package more over time. The fact that some of these things are ending pretty soon, right as the Delta variant cases are getting worse, is not super encouraging. But it's, as I said, it's very hard to tell like how big the marginal impact on hiring is or on other economic activity is right now.
Lynette, scale of 1 to 10, how worried are you, as Catherine points out, that the relief and the benefits are being ended as, well, I don't even know what that noise was. Maybe it was Lynette. Well, we'll see. Maybe it's actually just Catherine. Catherine, you still there?
I'm still here.
All right, good. So let's keep going here. Scale of 1 to 10, then, how worried are you?
Repeat the question.
Yeah. How worried are you, scale of 1 to 10, that these two things are happening at the same time, that the Delta variant is ramping up and there's some business concern and the fiscal relief is going away?
I don't know exactly where I fall on that numerical scale. I would say I'm more concerned about the Delta variant than I am about the fiscal relief at this point, just because we've only very recently started reopening large swaths of the economy. People are had been more comfortable going to restaurants and traveling, going to the movie theater, et cetera, resuming their normal lives. And I'm concerned that quite reasonably people may retrench and decide that they're no longer going to, you know, feel comfortable doing all of those things, which will, of course, hurt economic activity, whether or not, you know, UI factors into that. I don't know. Right. There have been a lot of other programs that have been slow to get money out as well. Yeah. So if they end, you know, like with the rent relief, you know, that a lot of that money hasn't gone out. If it ends, I don't know that we're going to see much of a difference either way.
Right. Lynette, you back?
I'm back.
All right.
Sorry
good.
About that.
Oh, it's all right. You know, things happen.
There's a hurricane coming.
I heard, believe it or not. You know, things happen. Live radio. Last question to you, and it goes like this, and it's of a theme with some of the conversation we've been having the last 6 minutes about the Delta variant. Goldman Sachs this week came out and said, you know what, we're going to revisit our third quarter estimate for gross domestic product. We're going to cut it from 9% growth in the third quarter to 5.5% growth annualized. Yes, 5.5% is still amazing, but holy cow, that's a big cut. What do you make of that?
You know, there are parts of this economy that are going to be hit really hard by the Delta variant and places where people are not vaccinated. But the big cities, a lot of blue states, they're going to keep chugging along.
Yeah.
So at least it's not going to be as bad as it was in March 2020. But we do have to consider that the parts of the economy that were opening up and looking good are going to look less good. Look, right. Macy's, Kohl's, these retailers that are mostly brick and mortar, they had banger prints this week, great earnings. Right. So we know that it can come back if it's under control. I think we know what we need to do. And that at least puts us in a better position than we were in a year ago.
Small blessings. Lynette Lopez at Business Insider and Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. Wall Street today, traders wrapped up a bumpy week to the upside. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. We just spent, 7, maybe 8 minutes on this program reading the economic tea leaves, Catherine, Lynette, and I did. Here is another 90 seconds of it on a more tangible indicator, copper. If perchance you have been watching the copper market, you might be a little bit worried. After an all-time high in May, copper prices have tumbled 10% or so. And yes, other commodities are seeing similar dips. But when it comes to forecasting the macroeconomic future, copper has its own special reputation. Marketplace's Matt Levin has that one.
Kai, if you ever need a last-minute expert for the weekly wrap, may I suggest Dr. Copper? That's the slang term commodities traders use for the copper market. It's thought to be so good at predicting the economy, it has a PhD in economics.
So that's where the nickname comes from. Copper has always been viewed as sort of a precursor for the direction of local and global economies.
Bobby Acino is a Chicago-based commodities trader. He says the reason why is pretty simple.
So regardless of what era you're talking about economically, copper has been a factor in anything that needs to be built.
Plumbing, electrical wiring, bullets, cars. So when prices rise, that could be a sign GDP is about to grow. And when they fall?
So there was a day where it broke substantially. It had fallen like 15 cents a pound. That was truly a wake-up call.
Philip Strebel is chief market strategist with Blue Line Futures. He says the recent dip in copper prices can be traced to many things, tapering stimulus, the Delta variant, but mostly...
copper is really connected to the Chinese economy.
China consumes about 50% of the world's copper. Strebel says the drop in copper prices coincides with a general cooling of the Chinese economy. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
If somehow you miss us on the air, we get it. It's all right. Happens. Check out our podcast, though, would you? We've all seen and heard about the chaos on the ground at the airport in Kabul. President Biden said this afternoon the United States has moved 13,000 people out of Afghanistan in the past 6 days, both American citizens and Afghans applying for special immigrant visas, SIVs, they're called. And although they are safe once they've gotten on those planes, there is work to be done to settle those immigrant visa holders here. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams spent a day with one of the groups doing that.
You got it?
No, you're not.
Strong.
Yeah. Break your back. You got a lot of work to do this week.
Volunteers from the D.C. area nonprofit Homes Not Borders are maneuvering a used but clean beige love seat out of what had been a packed rental truck. The group made quick work of unloading tables, a TV stand, bed frames, and mirrors. It's a start for this two-bedroom unit in the Maryland suburbs, in a complex with a giant sign at the entrance that says, "Refugees Welcome."
This is an apartment for a family of six that came from Afghanistan, and we're just dropping off some of the larger items for it now that we got from a donor.
Laura Thompson-Osuri is executive director of the group and says they'll be back later to add the finishing touches, donated dishes, bed linens, artwork for the walls. She can barely pause to explain what she's doing because she has to keep everyone moving.
We've seen a surge in the D.C. area, and last week we did set up for four families. We have seven families this week, and there's at least four more next week.
Normally, it would be more like one or two setups in a week. In addition to that surge of people coming in, the process for getting them settled has been upended by the security situation in Afghanistan, says Ruben Chakrasekar, who runs the Maryland Division of the International Rescue Committee.
Under normal circumstances, SIVs would be processed through the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, right? And they would get all of their paperwork in order and then fly here through a commercial flight.
Now, many are arriving at military bases here in the U.S. to finish the process.
Okay. He's going for the bottom, so let's go for the bottom.
Getting them into their new homes from there takes a lot of volunteer labor, says Lauren Thompson-Osuri of Homes Not Borders.
This is my niece and nephew and my sister who breaks up the truck, and then we have some helpers, Amal and Athir.
That's Amal Abuldood and her husband, Athir Abdullah. They came to the U.S. from Iraq on special immigrant visas a few years ago to an apartment like this one, which Amal Abuldood says made all the difference as they settled into their new lives.
Any people, Afghanistan, African, any people new coming, I wish I helped them free. Because I know if I'm coming to America, many people help me. I want to do the same these people help.
Watching all the scenes of desperate people trying to flee Afghanistan is prompting lots of people to help just now, says Homes Not Borders Director Osuri. At the group storage facility in Landover, Maryland, shelves are packed with dishes and cutlery, board games and kids' toys, all to help make empty apartments feel more homey. And so new arrivals don't have to spend the roughly $1,200 a person families get from the U.S. government.
So we are saving them that money and then also providing them a lot more. You know, they get a full set of dishes. They get coffee tables, end tables, lamps, TVs, all that kind of stuff.
Not all the donations are clean or useful or in good shape. The group keeps a whole wall of weird knickknacks and art they are not putting into anyone's apartment.
This is our fine collection of weirdo-ness. My creepy picture of bunnies is my favorite.
Homes Not Borders has also received an influx of cash donations.
Which is great. We can use it, you know, for our storage, for trucks. We hopefully will buy a truck soon. So that's great. We're hoping to hire some more movers.
And Osuri says she has dozens of new volunteer applications to work through once she gets a moment to breathe, which, given the thousands of Afghan families on the way, is unlikely to be anytime soon. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
understanding its employees' needs.
Just trying to keep the workforce happy, you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rebounded 225 points today, 0.6%, 35,120 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ advanced 172 points, nearly 1.2%, finished at 14,714. The S&P 500 added 35 points, about 0.8%, 44,041. For the week that was, the Dow off 1.1%. The NASDAQ shaved off about 0.7%. The S&P 500 dropped nearly 0.6%. Matt Levin told us about the importance of copper to this economy and how the recent decline in prices is worrisome. Well, of course, because we did that story, today copper futures up 2.5%. Speaking of economic indicators, heavy equipment makers can be that Deere, purveyor of the big green tractor from its base in the Quad Cities, beat forecasts for revenue and earnings and said demand for farm equipment is solid, but shares still down 2.1%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A story now about how companies that seem dead kind of sometimes aren't. Macy's says it's going to open up Toys R Us shops inside more than 400 of its stores next year. And if you're thinking right now, Kai, wait, man, Toys R Us is bankrupt, went into Chapter 11, shut down its U.S. businesses entirely. Well, you'd be right. That did happen. But as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports, sometimes dead doesn't actually mean dead.
It's a weird one to explain. Because in the U.S., Toys R Us did go out of business. Shut down its stores, laid off more than 30,000 people, sold all its inventory. Then, in 2018, there was a bankruptcy auction for the intellectual property that was left over.
That would be the names Toys R Us, Babies R Us, Jeffrey the Giraffe.
James Zahn is senior editor of the Toy Insider.
And the parties involved at the time,
some of the lenders that Toys R Us owed money to,
decided to cancel the auction and keep the IP for themselves.
And they tried to monetize it. They opened pop-up shops at Kroger under the name Jeffrey's Toy Box. They partnered with Target to have the Toys R Us website send customers to Target.com. They even opened a couple experiential stores, then shut them down in the pandemic. And now here we are with the Macy's partnership. The lenders aren't calling the shots anymore. Toys R Us is now controlled by a brand management company called WHP Global. And it's not actually a retailer anymore.
They do not operate any retail stores. They do not operate their e-commerce. You could essentially say that they're an IP company.
That's why this partnership with Macy's is so important.
Steph Wissink is a managing director and senior research analyst at Jefferies.
Macy's is a retailer that has real estate stores. Macy's is a retailer that has an inventory purchasing infrastructure.
What Macy's wants is more customers, and it's betting that the Toys R Us name will bring them into stores. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
This has been, and you don't need me to tell you this, a tough year and a half. And at this point, we could all probably use a little bit of empathy, which, says the dictionary, can be defined as the ability to understand and share the feelings of another. A good trait for humans to possess, indeed, but can a company for which you work really share your feelings? A lot of them are trying right now, or at least say they are. Anna Helen Peterson wrote about the rise in corporate empathy for Time magazine. She also writes a newsletter at Substack called Culture Study. Anna Helen, welcome to the program.
I am so happy to be here.
I need you to start, with the basics, right? What does it mean for a company to be empathetic, and should a company even be doing that?
So theoretically, a company that is empathetic is listening to and understanding its employees' needs in a 360 way. So that means their needs outside of the workplace. So if they have obligations or distractions or difficulties, there is an understanding of why that is happening and why the worker might need different accommodations.
Which is all great, and I'm going to come off as the jerk here, but if I'm running the Acme widget company, my job is to make and sell widgets and make money. And keeping my employees safe and well-trained and all of that is my job. But dealing with the rest of it maybe isn't. I don't know.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, part of the difficulty here is that this really came out of the last year and a half of companies trying to figure out how to keep morale up in the face of what's happening with COVID. And an overarching strategy, which really feels like an HR buzzword initiative, is that we are going to try to be empathetic. And I think it's more, wow, we're having some attrition problems and company culture is really bad. So how can we adopt a strategy that makes it seem like we are trying to figure out how to be this way towards our employees?
Yeah, and the catch with this coming in HR speak, as it were, and please, HR professionals, do not at me on this one. HR works for the company.
Yes. And I think that the way that a lot of these initiatives, whether it's empathy in the workplace, which is a very popular one right now, another one is bringing your whole self to work, is they come...
Explain that a little bit, though, the whole self thing, because that's really relevant here.
Yeah. So the bringing your whole self to work is that understanding that, like, you are a person who has an identity and who has responsibilities outside of whatever your task is in the workplace. And so that means, if you are a Black person, you are showing up with all of the burdens and difficulties and racism that accompanies being a Black person in the United States when you show up to work. Now, again, the difficulty is companies want to model this attitude, but aren't necessarily prepared or willing to deal with slight decreases in productivity.
How would I know if my company is trying to be empathetic toward me?
Well, usually you know because there is an email or a Slack message that's like, we are modeling empathy in the workplace. Sometimes workers told me that they found out that their employer was trying to be empathetic in the workplace because the CEO gave an interview. There's just this overarching disconnect that makes a lot of employees, at least that I've spoken with, they're like, this is all BS.
Yeah. So after having reported this piece and written it, what's your takeaway? I mean, is it working? Is it worth it? You know?
So here's what I hear again and again. The best way to show that you are actually empathetic is to create policies that make it easier for people like to have lives. Back to the office plans that don't require all workers to be in the office at an arbitrary time. Mm-hmm. Plans that don't have any room to acknowledge that people are mothers or caretakers or have disabilities that make it difficult. I think that what we come back to again and again is that a lot of this messaging that I think people are learning or are receiving is, I feel broken, you feel broken, I'm empathetic about you feeling broken, but also could you please do your job?
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes anyone feel better.
Anna Helen Peterson writes a newsletter called Culture Study. Anna Helen, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in which I am not making this up. You remember the Ever Given, the cargo ship that got stuck sideways in the Suez Canal back in March? Stopped up $10 billion in global trade a day for almost a week. Entered the canal again last night, that ship did. Made it this time. All right, we are on our way, but here is your moment of economic context. I really should have thrown this into Matt Levin's lead for the copper story because it's kind of related. Another commodity that is sagging a bit, one that is real responsive to consumer demand, oil. The U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate down for the ninth day in a row today, $62.25 a barrel. I'll tell you what, if Mitchell Hartman had been on duty today, this would have been one for the Marketplace Desk of Economic Peril. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday. Everybody, have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.